Thank you, Lynn. On behalf of Spark and myself, I'd like to thank John Walensky and the Public Knowledge Project and the SFU Library for inviting us to participate in this first PKP International Scholarly Publishing Conference. I suspect many of you are familiar with Spark and some of its initiatives. Spark is an initiative of the Association of Research Libraries. It has about 800 member libraries worldwide and affiliates in Europe and Japan. Again, I suspect most of you are familiar with Spark's education and advocacy programs in support of open access. But from the outset, Spark's also explored and been actively involved in identifying. Was everybody able to hear any of that? Identifying alternative income and business models and operating models capable of supporting scholarly communication and scholarly publishing. And that's initiatives such as BioOne and Euclid are good examples of that. And our work with publishing cooperatives on publishing cooperatives is a continuation of that program. What I'd like to talk to you about today is basically cover three points. First, I'd like to describe why society publishers are economically important, not only to themselves, but also to libraries, and specifically the self-publishing society publishers. I'd like to then talk about some of the market issues that society publishers face and some of the internal structural constraints they have to deal with that make it difficult for them to sustain their self-publishing operations. And then I'd like to propose publishing cooperatives as an operating and financial model capable of responding to those market issues and those structural constraints. So first, I'd like to talk about why society publishers are economically important, and again, self-publishing societies in particular. To understand this, and also to understand some of the market issues that they face, it makes sense to review the market that society publishers operate in. Based on an analysis of Ulrich's periodicals directory in the spring of 2005, we could identify about 23,000 scholarly and scientific journals, peer-reviewed journals. Of these, about 45% are owned outright by commercial publishers, with a heavy concentration in a few very large publishers. And the remaining 55% were sponsored by societies and university programs. Significantly, of the society journals, approximately a third of them were published on behalf of the society by commercial publishers. In other words, the society had outsourced the publication to a commercial publisher. What's significant about this is that this whole universe of publications is growing at a fairly steady rate of about 3.5% a year, and for-profit journals are increasing at about twice the rate of nonprofits. So if this were to extend for another 20 years, and leaving aside the issue of whether there'd be journals or articles or issues or anything like that, notwithstanding, it's the scale of publication would keep increasing. The issue is the ownership of it. If this were to continue in about 20 years with the market, with the universe doubling every 22 years or so, almost 70% of this kind of publication would be controlled by commercial publishers. So why is this important? Well, as you're all keenly aware, there's a differential in pricing between society-published and university journals and commercially published journals. Commercial journals typically cost four or five times more than society self-published journals, and this is based on the analysis done by Ted Bergstrom and Elizabeth Dewey, and also in the LISU studies. But there are plenty of documentation for the price differential. And also significantly, society-sponsored journals that are published on behalf of the society by a commercial publisher cost three times what the self-published journals cost. So this is obviously has a direct, immediate, and long-term economic impact on libraries. Another aspect of the market that's important to remember is that you have a large number of very small society publishers and nonprofit publishers competing against a very small number of very large commercial publishers. Indeed, again, based on the Ulrich's analysis I mentioned earlier, Almost 90% of society's publish just one journal. Another 8% publish two or three, and less than 3% of societies publish four or more journals. And it's important to keep this in mind when we're thinking about societies or we're disparaging their reaction and response to open access calls and other things, that we're not talking about the American Chemical Society and IEEE and all the large reactionary, if you will, society publishers. We're talking about a much larger group of very small publishers, most of whom don't have professional executive management, let alone professional or full-time business management or editorial management of their journals. Another important thing to keep in mind is, not everything is online yet. Now, this data is a couple of years old, but it hasn't changed that much. There's still a sizable minority of society journals, journals overall, that are still only available in print format. And this has puts significant strains on small societies as they're looking to move from print to online. There are a lot of issues that they have to deal with that we'll talk about in a minute, and a lot of risk that they have to overcome that we can't minimize. So to summarize the market and why societies are self-publishing is economically important. The market's growing. The share of the market controlled by commercial publishers is growing at a much faster rate than for nonprofit publishers. The number of society publishers that are outsourcing to commercial publishers is also growing, and there's a significant price differential between nonprofit and for-profit journals. So now I'd like to talk a little bit about how this market environment affects societies and also some of the internal constraints that they face. Not surprisingly, operating in a mixed market with much stronger competitors puts a lot of pressure on a subscription model for society publishers. The price differentials themselves capture a lot of budget dollars. The charging models and bundling also captures a lot of a larger share of the budget dollar. And this is an environment where library budgets have stayed effectively flat for the last 25 years or so. I mentioned earlier how that we have a large number of very small society journals competing against a small number of very large commercial journals, and this translates into limited market share and market power on a competitive basis for society journals. The increased demand for technology and better discovery and functionality on delivery platforms is also a significant pressure on society publishers, whether they've even after they've moved online. And we're talking here not just about the rudimentary PDFs and HTML, but actually fully featured kind of functionality. It's very expensive to maintain. It's expensive to set up. And individually, acting alone, small society publishers aren't well positioned to do this. Another significant factor that sometimes isn't taken into account is in a transition from print only to online, it raises real member retention issues for societies. It depends on the publication benefit package that they have. It depends on all sorts of other issues. It depends on whether they're the primary society in their field or a secondary or even tertiary society. But these are issues that are in the very front of the minds of the society leaders making the decisions about whether to go online and how to respond. And another, and perhaps slightly surprising, market pressure on them are more market reactions to high prices. Open access, for example, and this is an understandable and market reaction. But from a society perspective, it's another another pressure on them in terms of how to respond. All of these pressures together are what are leading to an exodus from self-publishing to outsourcing. And stating it in biblical terms of exodus may be a bit overstating it, but nevertheless, there's a steady migration of about 3% a year, and cumulatively, that's not insubstantial. In addition to these market issues that society publishers face, there are internal constraints that they have to deal with. Now, some of these are exist for nonprofits across all market sectors, but some of them are singular to society publishers. first and foremost, or at least first, insufficient staff resources. As we said, most of the societies are very, society publishers are very small, don't have full-time staff, if they have any staff at all. They're focused on their core competence in terms of editorial processes, content acquisition, certification, and the like. And they don't have sufficient resources to do business management, financial analysis, strategic planning, and a lot of the kinds of planning and business analysis that you need to do to deal with a market that's changing and dealing from a transition from print only to online, and to determine what your risk profile is in making these changes. And this is one of the constraints, and a very significant constraint for many small societies in terms of responding to calls for open access, calling for changes from a subscription model. If we bear in mind that most of these societies aren't actively managing their subscription bases now, if it weren't for libraries and subscription agents, nothing would happen at all. I mean, they've been publishing these journals for a long time, in most cases. They're being purchased, but they're not actively selling them and marketing them. And we have to bear that in mind as we're talking about moving to new business models and new income models, that we're asking people who aren't even sustaining their current business model to move to a new one. Another important constraint on society publishers, and one that they share with other nonprofits, is that they don't have ready access to investment capital. One of the reasons why the commercial firms can make the investments they do in technology and have state-of-the-art platforms and be aggressive about acquiring new content is they have access to capital markets. Nonprofits don't have that kind of access. And this has multiple effects, but two significant ones is that it hinders society's ability to respond to demand for new publications. This gets largely ceded to commercial publishers now because it takes, with a science journal, typically about 5 years before reaching operating break-even, let alone full recovery of investment. It's longer for social science journals, and for humanities journals, it can be 10 years or longer. Many societies simply can't afford that kind of investment, that kind of in starting new publications. And where commercial publishers can, and that's why there's a lot of the new developments being taken up by the commercial publishers. It also impedes technological innovation and development of platforms. And again, we're not talking about rudimentary PDF and HTML. We're talking about the kinds of data mining and content manipulation and features and functionality that you see in some of the commercial platforms. Not that all of these things are absolutely necessary, but a lot of them are in demand by researchers and users, and society publishers and other nonprofits simply aren't in a position to make that kind of initial investment on the ongoing investment in technological innovation. The innate conservatism of nonprofits and certainly of societies specifically affects the way they perceive the risk in terms of transitioning from one model to another, from leaving what they're comfortable with to going someplace where they're less comfortable. If you don't have the resources to analyze the risk, to know what the financial impact will be, what the chances are of there being any kind of impact, that really constrains the speed and the likelihood of society publishers transitioning from one model to the next. And this is in addition to in some fields, still resistance to or affinity for print that some of us find odd. But it's very important from a financial standpoint. And also, in a more positive note, it affects their desire to retain control of their publishing operations. That's good because it slows a little bit the outsourcing, and they're more and more aware, largely through through library initiatives, that they need to retain copyright control or ownership, rather, of not cede all of that to the commercial outsourcer, but that's still an issue that has to be taken into account. So looking at the shared issues that society publishers face, we see that they're very small. They're because acting individually, they have very little market power in purchasing services, whether it's print or online or whatever. Because they are acting independently against a small number of very large commercial publishers, they have very little market visibility and market power as sellers. They don't have sufficient staff resources, which causes them not to have access to key services, especially in terms of strategic planning and risk assessment. They're undercapitalized, and they're conservative and risk-averse. So why do we think cooperatives offer an appropriate response to this? Well, first I'd like to go talk about what cooperatives are, how they work, and why, then describe why we think they're an appropriate response to the needs of society publishers. First, cooperatives are everywhere. They've been around since, informal sense, since at least the Industrial Revolution. They're in all sectors of the market and all industries, from in very small storefronts, small operations, to very large Fortune 500 companies. They're in every continent, virtually every country around the world, in all sorts of areas, in housing, financial services, certainly agriculture. 30% of U.S. agriculture goes through a cooperative of some sort, and consumer and retail cooperatives as well. Also, just in terms of recognition, 40% of the Canadian population, and also coincidentally 40% of the U.S. population, belong to at least one cooperative. In terms of types of cooperatives, and this may explain why you belong to a cooperative and aren't aware of it, credit unions and housing cooperatives make up a large proportion of these, and consumer cooperatives in general that provide access to retail services and goods that at prices that that consumers wouldn't otherwise have access to. Producer cooperatives allow producers to process and market and sell their goods in a way that allows them to move up the food chain and the value and add value, especially in volatile markets. And shared services or purchasing cooperatives allow small individual organizations to come together to purchase or provide or both services that the organizations wouldn't otherwise have access to. Couple of prominent examples, or at least visible examples, in North America, the True Value and Ace Hardware, shared services cooperatives. Independent hardware stores, neighborhood hardware stores, that have very little chance of competing against large box stores like Lowe's and Home Depot. Coming together in a cooperative allows these small independent stores to have access to marketing and sales, distribution, product, that they wouldn't otherwise have access to acting alone. And True Value and Ace, between them, have some 12,000 independent stores and about $16 billion in sales annually. And this collective action allows the small independent hardware stores to compete against the large warehouse stores. In terms of what cooperatives are, there are three basic principles that apply to all cooperatives, irrespective of market or industry. First, they're owned by their members. Member equity, as opposed to an investor-owned firm, where ownership of the firm is based on how much an individual or a company invests, cooperatives are, the ownership is determined by how much an organization uses the cooperative, its patronage of the cooperative. The cooperative is controlled by its members, typically on a democratic basis, on a one member, one vote basis. And the cooperative exists solely for the benefit of its members. It doesn't exist for its own benefit to generate income or surplus. It exists for its members, and that manifests itself in terms of allowing the members determining what services they want, and the cooperative providing services at cost. And we'll describe how that works in a minute. Just to give a very simple, but I hope to be simple, financial overview of how cooperatives work, I want to step through how this works. It's not magic that they're able to generate, provide services at cost, and that they're able to help small firms generate capital. But it would be useful to step through it to see how it actually works. First, a cooperative would offer its services at market rate. So it's starting with a cost and a surplus. They need to offer it at a market rate for two reasons. One, it has to be competitive with what a publisher could get elsewhere from some other service provider. Also, it can't be too low, or it won't have enough surplus to generate the capital that we're going to describe in a second. On an annual basis, the part of the surplus is refunded as cash to individual publishers based on their use of the cooperative. So right away, that's on an annual basis, about 25% typically of the surplus would be returned as cash, patronage refunds, to participating publishers. So right away, this lowers their the cost of the of services. The rest of the surplus is retained as member equity, and this is allocated to the members, again, based on their use of the cooperative, the same way as the cash refund was. And this is records are kept of this, and the ownership is reflected in this equity. Over time, as the equity builds, the cooperative's board of directors determines that it's adequately capitalized and starts refunding, distributing this equity to the members as it was allocated originally. So this is a very important aspect of the cooperative in that it keeps the ownership of the cooperative in the hands of the publishers that use it over time. So if the use shifts, a publisher starts using more of the services over time that publisher will have more ownership in the cooperative. And this is important to make sure that the services of the cooperative and the needs of the publishers are taken into account. So what might a publisher cooperative look like? How might it form? I don't know how easy it is to read this, so I'll describe it a little bit. In its simplest form, a group of societies or nonprofit publishers, even for-profit publishers for that matter, could come together typically with a shared interest in a discipline, by type of publisher. They may NGOs and biodiversity, for example, may feel they have sufficient affinity to act together to come to form a cooperative. The publishers, the members of the cooperative, would decide what set of services they want to offer. What we provide up here is there's a whole list: business management services, scale bargaining and purchasing, marketing services, digital hosting and publishing services, or any or all of these and other services that could be offered by the cooperative. But the members would decide what they would want to use. Not every society, not every member of the cooperative would need to use all of the services. They can use what they want when they need them, which is one of the strengths of the cooperative model, and it also, again, it affects ownership. This group of publishers acting cooperatively could offer a content offering to libraries and to other markets, or not. And it could offer an aggregation, it could do title by title, it could decide not to offer a content offering at all separately. It would depend on the cooperative. This could easily scale. As you add new satellite cooperatives in other disciplines, this increases the economy of scale available to all of the publishers in participating. So they would, in terms of scale economies in purchasing and production services, marketing services, and the like. Each of these individual groups, different disciplines or types of publishers, could have their own equity policies and pooling and keep those discrete, so they would act as separate cooperatives, but they would still benefit in a federated type environment from the overall economies of scale. And again, they could offer content offerings separately or not at all. And this can continue expanding with multiple federated cooperatives acting to get greater economies of scale. Now, this may seem a little bit aggressive or ambitious given that there are no cooperatives yet, but in terms of showing that it is scalable and replicable, I think that's one of the important aspects of this model as opposed to a lot of the collaborative models available now. And also want to use this to point out that this shows a shared digital publishing platform, and this could be provided by a library publishing service or a shared service of some sort, and with discipline-specific or other kinds of open archives supported by the cooperatives as well. Now, in terms of cooperative structures, what I've been describing with the previous few slides just basically described a standard publisher cooperative that has an arm's length relationship with libraries and other markets. But it's a logical question to ask is how could libraries be involved, since this would benefit libraries, and what role could libraries play? Well, one of the important things to remember about cooperatives, and what's demonstrated from volumes of research in other markets and industry sectors on cooperatives, is that the shared interest and homogeneity is very important in terms of the longevity and the success of the cooperative. And while publishers and libraries at a mission level share many objectives from scholarly communication and scholarly publishing, at an operational level there are some very real differences. And so those kinds of differences have to be taken into account when structuring a cooperative that includes both publishers and libraries. And one of the models I think that would be worth looking at, and there are others as well, but one that's been demonstrated in other market sectors, is an investor share cooperative, which would establish different classes of shares of ownership in the cooperative that would allow libraries to come in and funders and other stakeholders and to purchase a stake in the cooperative, which would give them a different ownership and control right than the publishers themselves. And this would allow the balance of ownership and control to make sense and to the divergence of interest not to be too great. And this wouldn't be done for cash return typically on the part of libraries. But it could manifest itself in a number of ways in terms of discounts and control over what goes into the cooperative. So to summarize the cooperative benefits for the publishers, first it allows them to come together to act collectively to achieve what they couldn't achieve individually. It gives them increased market power and visibility, both on the sell side and on the buy side, and it gives them economies of scale and reduced costs. Both of these are important. Recall competing in a mixed market with against large commercial competitors where they have little market power and little market visibility. It allows them to get access to missing services, and this is a significant aspect of a cooperative model. Again, some of the issues that, and constraints that society publishers face in moving to new models comes from not having the kinds of business resources and strategic planning and feasibility analyses that they need. Acting together, they can get these kinds of services. And it allows them to pool capital and share risk. We talked about how they could pool capital, but they can also share risk together if they're looking at new models, whether it's going to open access or exploring new income models. They're more likely, if there's a band of homogenous society publishers, they could act together. They're more likely to do this than acting on their own. And cooperatives, clearly, because they're owned by the publishers, would allow societies to retain control of their publishing operations. So what's in it for libraries? Well, I think hopefully this is obvious by now, but it's lower content cost, moderate content cost, for a variety of reasons. One, the reduced cost to the societies will have a moderating influence on the price to libraries. This wouldn't necessarily be the case if a commercial publisher were receiving a reduced cost, but with societies, it's more likely that some of that savings will be passed on to the libraries. It also provides societies with the capacity to play a greater role in meeting market demand for new publications and for providing new publishing channels, and not ceding those to commercial publishers as they largely do now. It also provides a framework for alternative funding models. I just mentioned that a minute ago in terms of it provides a framework in which societies can look at how they might move to open access or move to new income models that they don't. They don't have a way to do now, acting individually. It also provides a group together that can work with libraries to share risk and transfer risk to help accelerate experimentation with new models, both income models and access models. If they're able to transfer some of the risk to libraries, which it's a risk I suspect many libraries would be willing to share, this will accelerate the pace of change. So, taken together, I hope it has shown at least that on major issues that society publishers, cooperatives rather, can help society publishers play a continued and productive and constructive role in nonprofit publishing and scientific and scholarly publishing, provide a new basis for new business models, And also, I think this is an important point, is that cooperatives can complement existing initiatives. They're not meant to displace anything. They can work with university presses, they can work with digital publishing operations and based in libraries, and all sorts of other existing initiatives. They're not mutually exclusive. They're not trying to, again, supplant anything. It's an organizational model and a financial model that societies can use in working with these already existing initiatives. And they're also scalable and replicable, which should allow them to the model to be taken up and expanded readily, as opposed to a lot of handcrafting on a project-by-project basis. So with that, I'll thank you for your patience and for the opportunity to discuss publishing cooperatives.